relative sexually assault me when I was very, very young, right? And it wasn't, you know, here's a piece of candy, don't tell your mom. It was violent and it was aggressive. And that is really what changed the course of everything, I feel, right? And when that happened, you know, he was a very terrifying man, right?
Hey, everybody. So that was Chad Valier, our guest this week, sharing a very vulnerable memory of his and one of the early childhood traumas that he faced. This episode is very raw, very real. We spent a lot of time talking about the message as opposed to the mess. And Chad is just an absolute pleasure to have on as a guest. And I do appreciate his vulnerability that he's able to show. So, guys, the title sponsor for today's is, of course, the Yatra Trauma Treatment Center here in Krabi, Thailand, where I'm currently living. I started my healing journey here in Thailand at Yatra when I came out to address the PTSD that was really holding me back in life. So check them out, guys. They are a clinic run by clinicians, not a business run by businessmen. And they know that where addiction is a smoke, trauma is fire. Their website is yatracenter.com. That's yatracentre.com. Thanks, guys. Here's the show. Hello, everybody, watchers and listeners, supporters of all kinds. Welcome to another episode of the Ass is Too Awesome podcast. I'm your host, Chuck LaFlange, checking in from Krabi, Thailand, halfway around the world in virtual studio, coming from Oshawa, Ontario. This is Chad Valier. How are you doing today, Chad?
I'm good, brother. How are you?
I'm great. It's 28 degrees now here at 11 p.m., so life could be worse.
Nice.
Life could be worse, right?
Yeah, you could be freezing to death in Oshawa.
Oshawa. I just can't do it, man. I can't. I do not miss even a little bit winter, right? I left on November 1st, like 2 days after the first snowfall in Calgary, where I was. And there's just no turning back, man. There's no turn. The only white shit getting in my shoes now is sand at the beach, right? You know, like I'm okay with that. So,
I finally get why old people move to Florida and shit.
Oh, fuck. Without a doubt, right? Without a doubt. Never mind the cost of living, right? Never mind the cost of living. So,
true.
You know, it's just true. I was telling you pre-recording, like I live in a nice place, right? Like it's a half duplex. It's two levels. I've got a yard. And I pay $140 Canadian dollars a month, right? It's just nuts, right?
It's insane.
If I showed you what $8 got me for food, it would blow your mind, right? Like two bags of groceries for $8, right? Yeah, it's absolutely nuts, right?
I refuse to buy food or buy groceries. I buy daily because I'm a guy who I cannot watch things go to waste. And the amount of money that I have to spend on groceries, right? Like what we get for even $50, you know? But if it went bad and I didn't eat it, I'd fucking lose my shit. Would it be like you not a chance? Hey, so
we're in an addictions podcast. Let's talk about this real quick because this is very, very relevant.
Yeah.
For me, I buy daily as well. And I buy daily because I do things to excess, right? So like if I have three bags of groceries here, I'm going to eat three bags of groceries until I don't have three bags of groceries. Like that's just the way it is.
That's right.
You know, right? And so I have to put myself in check.
Well, I go through little phases.
Yeah, I'm gaining weight again. So, okay, let's get back to daily. Like, let's not try and stockpile because we know it doesn't work like stockpiling. I'm just going to sit here and binge eat until it's all gone, right? Just like crack back in the day, you know, right? Like, yeah.
Right. And that's the difference. So, like, I know now, right now. So, I go through these little phases. So, first, you know, if I'm really hungry, I'll put on my shoes and I'll walk across the street to the grocery store. Right. If I'm just snacky, I'll pull out of the cupboards. Right. But I go through these little phases because everything is excess for me. Even my healthy stuff is excess, you know, multiple meetings, like anything I can do to be of service, like things like that is always excessive. Right.
Yeah.
So I'll go through these little phases where I'll go on health binges and I will have, say, a bunch of junk food in my house and say it's Saturday. And I'm like, okay, so I'm going to go back to the gym Monday and I'm going to pound it out. When I go hard. And in my head, my addict brain tells me, well, you got to get rid of all the bullshit that's in your cupboards. Right. So I'll start like eating all the junk food and getting rid of it because Monday I don't want it there. Right. And I'll eat like all this stuff and I'll be sitting there, ugh, But I can't leave it there because I have to start fresh Monday.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. Sounds
but it's
right
my
to me.
Brain, and I know I'm wired that way, and it's everything. It's everything.
Yeah. Absolutely. Right. Yeah. Absolutely. A friend it's of mine so once bad. Was describing her husband and said, anything that goes near his mouth, right? It's like, you're kind of describing me right now, right? Like anything that comes in this general area, right, is going to get done way too much, right? You know, right? So, yeah. Anyway.
Well, as soon as I could taste again and my nose wasn't burned off my face.
Yeah. Septum, that's deviated as fuck. Right? That's what I like to say. Yeah.
But it's like I could taste food, and I was just like, this is delicious. This is what I've been missing for 15 years, 20 years.
Right. Yeah. I hear you. Anyway, hey, listen, before we get into some deeper conversations, Chad, I'd like to, as we talked about pre-recording, kind of establish, you know, some credibility for the audience, I guess, right, as to who you are and what's going on in your life. And I know you've had some pretty big pivotal moments in your life. That I'm aware of through that 10-minute documentary, which is awesome. I'll put the link in the show notes for you guys. And as well, of course, the live stream that we did on Black Cash Radio this past Friday. So why don't you kind of give us the Reader's Digest version of how you get to a point where you're on a recovery podcast and kind of go from there? Yeah.
Sure. Well, I mean, I grew up in a house with addicts. My parents were addicts. There was always partying at my house. I grew up to think that, you know, the lifestyle of partying and carrying on in motorcycle clubs and things like that was a way of life. I didn't know really any different. In that process, I mean, there was my parents didn't know any better either. Right. They were raised very shabbily, and they brought me up in they did better than they had, mind you. Right. But the way they brought me up, like I was in a house with I have many siblings. Like my dad had 12 kids. I also have a stepsister. So there's 13 kids. Volume and violence was in my house. Punishments, cruel and unusual. Spent a lot of time in my room, learned how to sing, became a musician. From the time I was 11, I sang.
What do you mean by that?
Well, cruel and unusual. So there was no real spankings, there was beatings, right? And it was you get punched out, whatever was in my mom's hand would go across the head or the back or wherever you try to do these kind of things, and it's you're getting these, right? Or my dad was very violent. My dad was very aggressive, and women, man, it didn't matter, they got it if he was angry, right? So the thing I talk about in the documentary is there was a time I got sent to my room when I was 11 years old, and I went in the winter and I got out in the spring. Right. And I've talked about this before. When you think about, I've never done any significant jail time, but when you do time in prison, right, in order to punish you, they take you out of the environment, the population, and put you by yourself. So you could be sitting there with murderers and arsonists and these people that could inflict great harm on you. And to punish you, they put you by yourself because this is not a good place for people. Right. So at 11 years old, when I'm in this room for the only thing I'm allowed to do is go to school, come home, eat supper, and I'm in my room the rest of that time. Right. So the only thing I was allowed to have was a radio. So I was blessed because I got to, I learned how to sing. Right. Or I realized I could. Some of it came really natural. So that was my thing. It was just music. But to me, that was going to be like music to me, those guys were like superheroes. Right. And I've said this lots of times. There was the sweat, the leather, the hair, the fire, and all the pretty girls and all the great things that looked like rock stardom. That was super attractive to me. Right. Yeah. Who doesn't want that when you're living in this shitty environment? I didn't long to be a hockey player. It was like, no, these guys look like they're having way more fun. Right. And in my parents' defense, my mom is not the person she was then. And I want it very clear, right? Like she's a great grandmother to my children and my siblings' children, but she didn't know better either. Right. So I got to put that out there because I've wrongfully represented her, I think, in the past, but I mean, my upbringing was still real.
I think that's a really powerful thing to do,
right?
Man.
So
a really powerful thing to do. Acknowledging that, this is how I got to where I was, but understanding that people change, no different than I as an addict or you as an addict have changed in your recovery. Your parents are very different people than they were 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, right? And I think it's all too often right. we sit and we I focus
around,
on that.
Right? How can I walk around expecting to be forgiven if I can't forgive? Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
But how can I walk around expecting to be forgiven if I can't forgive? Right? And it just comes down to today I know that those things wouldn't happen, but sadly, you know, we were the casualties and I made my children casualties. Yeah. You know, and that's what happens. Like I have three children and, you know, my son is 28, my daughter's 26, my other daughter's 15. Right. And they were casualties of the same behaviors because that's what I knew. Today, I would never do the things in front of them that they saw. Like I was not physically abusive. Like I didn't beat my kids or anything like that, but I wasn't a good dad. Like I wasn't, I didn't show up. You know what I mean? I just, to me, partying, and like I said, like it was music. So I was out playing the shows, you know, living the life and not showing up as a human for the people that mattered because I was so caught up in a selfish, self-centered, self-seeking life and behaviors that I didn't know. I was in survival mode because, you know, regardless of whether I had a home and food and a roof over my head and all that stuff, nobody showed up for me. Right. Yep. So selfishness became really easy.
Yeah.
You know, when children's aid are showing up at my house and I'm hiding dope, you know, and nobody, people know in my world, like my parents, pardon me, my parents, friends, and the people around us knew that was going on and didn't do anything. Who was showing up for me and my sisters, you know? And it was like, so you learn how to survive. And that's what it really, I didn't realize it at the time. It wasn't until I started really getting into recovery that I started realizing what was making me tick, you know?
So when's the first time you remember getting loaded? When's that happened for you?
Yeah, that's funny because I was stealing it's a story told and, you know, it used to be told around the table and, you know, everybody would laugh about it because again, you know, back then it wasn't uncommon for kids to run around the table and steal drinks or, you know, at least not where I come from. Right. And I remember getting all like, I don't remember it. I just remember the story being told, at nauseam, you know, where I'd be stealing drinks off the table Christmas Eve when I was like 2 years old and Christmas morning, they're trying to wake me up and I'm too sick and hungover. And I'm like, leave me alone. You know, I won't get up to open my gifts. And I remember so many times when that story was told, everybody be laughing. And I'm sitting here like, you know, after, you know, I got to an age when I realized that I was fucked up. You know, I'm starting to wonder, like, why is this funny? Like, if my kid was hungover at 2 years old, I'd want to kill the person who contributed to that. You know what I mean? So, yeah, it started that young. And then from the time I was, like, you know, old enough to find out where my mom hid her dope, I would steal that. Or the parties going on in my house, nobody would see me stealing the booze out of the fridge at 10 years old. And hiding in my room and pounding a couple beer, you know, like just because to me, like my mom's reasoning was if she exposed us to it, it would deter us from wanting to do it. But the thing was, is until things, you know, it looked like everybody was having fun until the fight would break out near the end of the night. And to me, that still didn't seem odd because it wasn't uncommon. Like, I didn't realize my life was different until I went to someone else's house. When I got into school and like some of these kids, you know, they'd come to school and they weren't obnoxious and they weren't like, you know, I'd go to their house and there'd be multiple forks on the table or, you know, like dessert or, you know what I mean? Like just weird shit that to me was like, wow, these guys are rich. They're eating dessert. I think it's because they're rich. You know what I mean? Because we grew up in next to poverty. Like we grew up in low income housing and you know, I remember, you know, moving into like, you know, a south end of Oshawa. They called it the other ghetto where I live. There's two main ghettos in Oshawa and they're both in the south end, but one's farther south. And I hung out down there and a lot of my friends that I grew up with were there, but I was in, they called it the other ghetto. Right? The Malaga Mansions. And I grew up there and, you know, I met guys and we were sharing one cookie amongst seven of us, you know, we'd share milk if we got, one of us got a glass of milk, holy shit, you know, we all took a sip of it, you know, and it was just like, that's how we rolled. We were swimming in like the sewers are back up because the way the townhouses were, the concrete would go like this and there'd be a sewer and then it would back up and we'd all be like diving in it because that was like swimming to us, you know. It was dumpster diving, just like total ghetto shit.
Yeah, right, right. Jeez, but, eh? Yeah.
We didn't know any better. We didn't know any different.
Yeah, yeah, right, right. So I know there's a couple key moments in your life. It sounds like your life is a key moment. But, yeah. You know what I'm referring to. Do you want to talk about that for us? And
like I said, you know, this is, I share this a lot simply because I'm trying to get into a field where I can make a difference. And the whole point of me coming out with this, so let's just get into it. So with all the partying going on in my house, you know, there was a lot of people in there and in and out of there. And to me, you know, I would sleep in front of my little sister's door, right? Because if somebody ever tried to get in there, they had to go over top of me. And for some weird reason, as a kid, I thought I could control that, right? And you know what I mean? But that puts you at risk. And you know, eventually that's what happened. Like, you know, I had a relative sexually assault me when I was very, very young, right? And it wasn't, you know, here's a piece of candy, don't tell your mom. It was violent and it was aggressive. And that is really what changed the course of everything, I feel, right? And when that happened, you know, he was a very terrifying man. Right. And he was a guy that looked like one of those guys. And he was, you know, associated with a lot of those fellows I was talking about earlier, like motorcycle clubs. He was never one of them, but he carried himself as though he was. And, you know, his biggest victims were always women and children, you know, and he didn't look like the kind of guy that would do things like that. Right. And I don't believe, like, I never took the chance in telling anybody. But I also knew at a very young age that when I started kind of, you know, figuring it out, that nobody would probably believe me anyway because of the type of man he was. And it wasn't until somebody else came out with it, you know, and this person was treated as though he was a liar and it didn't happen. And I had been to a meeting where I heard a man share his story. And this man, you know, he was also a survivor, and the person that had got him had gotten many other young men and when they were children. And these, you know, this guy picked up a newspaper and he saw a headline where these two men had killed themselves and it was due and they left notes. And basically it said that, you know, they were going to kill this guy, but instead it was easier to kill themselves. Like they couldn't deal with it anymore. And when they were treating this kid like he was lying, and I knew it had happened to me, I knew I had to get honest and I had to come forward because, you know, a lot of us don't. So there's many reasons why I kept it a secret. One, out of fear. Two, as you get older, whenever you hear of somebody getting caught doing that, the first thing they always say is, it happened to me. Right? Yeah. The last thing you want anybody to ever think is that you could do something like that. Right? You know, to me, that's the only part of my recovery that I can't overlook if somebody has done. Like when I meet somebody and they're in some kind of recovery of any kind, I can overlook anything they have done except that. Like to me, those people still to this day, in my opinion, need to be buried under the prison. Like I will never be accepting of anything that, you know, I don't care how sorry somebody is. It's unacceptable, right? And it's, you know, I refuse to keep letting people die because I was ashamed of something that I had nothing to do with, right? So I'm just at a point now when I finally come to terms with it and I was open about it, trust me, man, this, you know, I've had quite a few public conversations about it, but you know, sometimes it's tough, but it needs to be said and needs to be understood.
Yeah.
You know, I don't mind being the face for it. You know, I know that I didn't do anything wrong and that took a long time, you know, a lot of overcompensation through time, promiscuity, things that happened in my addiction, you know what I mean? Like there was a lot of things to overcompensate, making sure you always have a pretty girl on your arm. You know, don't ever call me the F word because I might stick something in your neck.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And it's like, because when you're a kid, you don't know what any of that stuff is. I didn't know what gay meant. I didn't know what that was when I was a child, but I knew something was not right with what happened.
Yeah.
Right. And things are, you know, we're older guys, you and me. So that stuff was also like, I mean, any kind of sexuality was looked at different. Right.
Damn straight.
So I was very cautious, you know, and I'm not gay, but I mean, there's, you know, when that kind of stuff happens, questions, there's questions, what's going on, you know, what's, you know, and so the last thing I wanted was anybody to think something I wasn't, because I was already struggling with identity. You know what I mean? So, and disconnect and all the things that made me feel not part of. So yeah. Why would I throw something else on or a concern or a question or a thought that might separate me even more? Okay. So you come out with something like that, right?
Oof. Wow.
Sorry, that's a lot. I know.
Yeah, no kidding. Eh? No kidding. So, I mean, really, let's be honest. You're not going to trump that with anything that you've that's happened as far as traumas go, right?
Right.
I mean, that's about as big as it gets, right there, right?
And sure.
I mean, yeah, we could sit around and we can make some bad jokes here and there, but I think there's a whole episode to be done on sense of humor and you know, once you've lived it, your bar moves and all that stuff. So, what else? I mean, is in your addiction, and we've talked about this, and it's kind of a peek behind the curtain to the listeners.
Sure.
The one thing that I'm kind of done doing now is talking about all the dumb shit and bad things and
right.
keys of this and fucking women that and all the things that we do in addiction, because I don't know. I'm just I like to focus more on the message now than the mess,
sure.
as we tend to say, right? What brings you to recovery, your real first kick at it? Right? Because I mean, quite often there's a bunch of like, I tried to quit, but we all know as people that are in recovery or for any amount of time anyway, there's a point where it's like, okay, my first real kick at the can. When is that for you?
My first real kick at the can was 8 years ago, almost 9 years ago. So I was in, so I had gotten busted, right? And I got caught with a bunch of dope and a bunch of money. And I'm not glamorizing this. If anything, it's shameful at this point. But I had decided at that point, like my life, I mean, it didn't change at all, but that was the one point where I'm going like, okay, like this, you know, something's got to give here. How can I use drugs successfully? Right. And I got out and I got my sentence, whatever it was, like I got some probation and a bunch of stuff. And, I remember the guy that I owed the money to found me. And, you know, regardless of whether I kept my mouth shut or not, this money was still owed. So I had to go back to work, which was not, you know, not my ideal situation, but I was with a girl and I'd been with her for quite some time. And it only took, you know, getting the product in my hand for us to go right back. Right. And she wasn't where I was. She didn't use drugs like I did. But it only took me being in charge of the product for her to fall into where I was. Right. So this went on for a little while and she left. She had had enough and she was done. And she's like, and I had been living a life that was like, put it this way. She was actually afraid to tell me it was done. She had to text me. Right. And we had been together 6 years. So that to me was like, I was supposed to start a tour with my band and the door got kicked in by my tour manager and I was just sitting there. And at that point I was like, okay, I got to go. But you know, I went like, we couldn't even start the tour, nothing. And I had to, so I went to rehab, but when I went to rehab, I still was only trying to use drugs successfully. That's all I wanted to do. You know what I mean? I was like, how am I going to do this so that my life doesn't suck? You know, how can I do drugs so I don't keep blowing up my life? So I went to a CBT one, like cognitive behavior therapy, and it was very army like regimented, right? And I went and I got out and then I got out and I was only out a short time when I knew I had to go back. But the only one available was a 12-step one. And that was my first introduction, right? So I got out and, you know, again, you know, I just felt like I was a drug addict. So I could drink. I was going to drink and be fine. And I drank right up until, you know, I found my drug of choice again and I went right back. Right. And then it was a 2-year run and it, you know, and after that, you know, I had my rock bottom this time. So when I went to rehab the first time and my life had fallen apart, I was all skinny and frail, and I was all methed out. I had sores all over my face, and it was a very physical, mental rock bottom. My life was shit. There was nothing left. You know, everything, my kids didn't have anything to do with me at that point. My partner had left me, and, you know, I went to rehab basically to try to get everything back, right? Yeah. And that's a common mistake with drug addicts. We just think we're going to get everything back when we do all the right things. So I get out of both of these rehabs back to back that I did. And altogether, I think it was probably 6 months altogether between the two of them. And I continued to drink and I started going to a 12-step program, but I was still drinking and lying and hiding and doing all this shit, you know. And then within a year of that, I met a woman and we ended up married and we walked out of the program. We didn't need it. Those guys were fucked. We weren't. We're good, right? We're going to continue to drink and carry on. And then I found drugs. You know, at my job, I found a bunch of drugs and I brought them home. And that was a 2-year run for me. And my rock bottom looked a lot different that time because it was spiritual, right? Like I still had a job. I was still, you know, heavy because I still maintained a life. I look good. I smell good. I, you know, made it look as though I was doing okay. But spiritually, I knew like I was done. I just couldn't. And I just remember waking up and I'd had my daughter. My daughter was out on the couch and I actually kneeled down beside her. She was sleeping and I prayed, right? And not to get all God on everybody, but I prayed my ass off and I begged for answers and I begged him, just show me. And that was it. And at that moment, I knew I couldn't again. Like I was just mentally, spiritually, like at that point. And I've shared this before, I didn't feel like I was going to relapse or like I was going to die. I thought I was going to kill myself. And I was just at that point where I wanted to fucking die. Like there was just, you know, there's no way I'm going to be able to stop this. I can't. I never had a good time. Not once in 2 years of doing drugs. Do I remember having fun once? Yeah. And I couldn't stop. That's how fucking messed up I was.
I got you, man. You know what? This isn't my story, but I'll share something with you.
Sure.
For the last year, year and a half, it's all gray. You know how that is. It's hard to put a timeline on it. I carried, like I was never an opiate guy. I never did fentanyl. I never, you know, heroin, none of that stuff. But I carried enough Fendi with me. I was made sure I had at least a half gram with me in case that was the day. In case that was the day that I decided that I finally had the courage. I'll use air quotes for that.
No, I know.
To do it, right? Like what a messed up way of thinking, but it's that addict brain, right? You know, it was just horrible, man. Horrible.
Well, when my partner left before that tour was supposed to start, I didn't have the, like, okay. So like, let's be clear, like suicide is a selfish act, but I don't think it's a cowardly act because it's fucking hard to do. Right. So I don't believe it's, you know, having the courage to kill yourself. I get that saying. You know, it's very selfish, but I know for a fact that when my partner left me, you know, eight, 9 years ago, I know that all I wanted to do was die. But to me, the thought of, you know, my parents or my mom or one of my sisters finding me, you know, smushed because I jumped in front of a train or hanging myself or something like that, you know, that would be very tragic. But if they found me in a room with a pipe in my hand or a rig in my arm, it was almost expected.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So my goal at that point, like now, if I'm being 100% honest, if I really wanted to, I could have found a way to die, but I wanted to use until I died. Right. And that was my goal at that point until, you know, I went to rehab. Right. And it was like for people to, you know, I have half my family are addicts and half aren't. So the ones that aren't don't understand why we're all so fucked up. Yeah. Right. They just don't get it. Right. And they will argue back and forth, you know, and we can do this till the cows come home. But science, genetics and medical fact will prove it's a fucking disease. So argue that all you want. I don't care. Yeah. You're wrong. Right.
Yeah.
Look it up. Right. Yeah. So, but you know, I didn't become a drug addict because I thought I was cool.
Yeah.
You know, right. It was far beyond that after drugs didn't make me feel good anymore and I couldn't stop.
Yeah. Right. Right. A good friend, actually, I'll see if I can pull this up. I might be able to. Dr. Lisa, who's my co-host on the Weekend Ramble.
I'm looking forward to meeting her.
Oh man, she's next level awesome. You talk about her a lot, so. I know, yeah. She's one of my favorite humans, man. She, her brother, and just what she said about the family. So her brother suffered an addiction, or has suffered an addiction for 20 plus years. And she she's never even smoked a cigarette. She quit her job as an oil field engineer in her 30s, or late 20s, 30s, to go back to school and become a psychiatrist to further understand her brother's struggle. To put that, like, so the lens that which she views things is so different than anybody, right? It's a one in a million view, man, right? Our lens to have. So I'm forever grateful to have her in my life. But she made a quote about addiction being a choice, and I'll see if this will play properly. If not, I'll cut it in after the fact, but see if this works.
Sure.
You know, this whole what we're talking about right now with choices, right? And people sort of pathologizing people with addiction as, well, you made the choice. This is a consequence of your choice. It came up in a conversation with an ex-boyfriend of mine, somebody who hadn't, you know, had no lived experience with addiction. This is a guy who he had partied. He'd done ecstasy. He'd done cocaine. Like, how as a teenager did my brother make any decision or choice different than you did? He had made the same choice as you did. He felt like he was young. He was a teenager. He was invincible, as a lot of teenagers think they are. The difference is I think that my brother was predisposed to this suffering. For him, those decisions were catastrophic. And I think other people are able to make the same choices and decisions, but they're able to walk away one day. So to me, it's like, how do we blame people who end up suffering in this disease for making the same choices that so many people make?
Isn't that just beautifully articulated?
I've always said this too. Like, so, you know, like I said, half my family are addicts, half aren't. So when I think about somebody arguing about whether it's a disease or not, so there's two big points that I like to make when this comes up. And one of them is, if drugs were the problem, they would do the same thing to everybody. They would have the exact same effect on everyone. It's a spiritual malady. It's the way we're wired, and not all of us are wired the same. We know this, right?
Yeah.
I often have said this. So like when somebody goes suntanning and they get skin cancer, you know, does somebody tell them they don't have cancer because they chose to sit in the sun?
No. Same diabetes.
You don't have disease because you made a fucking choice.
Yeah. There's so many correlations.
I don't have
here.
Lung cancer because I chose to smoke. Yeah. You fucking arrogant fuck.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it drives me insane. But I used to do that. I used to run to the aid of every addict on social media. I felt like it was my job. And I would fucking like go hard. And then it just gets to a point where you realize that people aren't going to fucking hear you if they don't want to. And it's just, you can argue till you're blue in the face. And, well, nope. It's a choice. No, dude, I can show you medical documents stating that
we have brain scans now. We know. Like, we know the brain does not have cognitive function when somebody is suffering an addiction. We know that. It's a thing. There's fancy computers and brain scans and stuff that are showing us that now, right? So, I mean, like, that's not even an argument worth having, really, in my mind.
Right.
No, like you said, if somebody doesn't want to hear you.
There's people who will fucking do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, right. It's crazy, right?
Yeah.
I just, for so long, I looked for a way to verbalize that. And when she said that in that episode, it was just like, boom, right?
Yeah.
Like, how can you argue with that? Right. How can a person argue with that?
Yeah.
You know, right. You know,
but I find the people that tend to be hating on addicts are usually people who have somehow been hurt by addicts.
And
if you've ever thought about that.
So here's the thing. I think about it often because and you know, I'll take a moment to talk about my sponsor here. For the title sponsor for the show is the Yatra Center here in Krabi, Thailand.
Yeah.
Now that, and I won't use the term trauma informed to describe myself, but now that I am closer to trauma informed than I ever was before, every time I hear somebody say something horrible, I wonder where it comes from.
Right.
Right. So a great example, there's a couple major, like, big Facebook groups for partners and spouses of addicts. It's one that's actually called that I'm a part of. kudos to them. If you are a partner or a spouse, you might want to check that out, because, and I know there's a lot of loved ones here that are, you know, that have people that are suffering an addiction that listen to us. They vetted me big time before letting me join that group, because I'm not a partner or a spouse, because I am somebody who was in it. But I had to prove to them that I'm, you know, really trying to spread a message here and help people. So, what ends up happening all too often, and I think I've never been to an Al-Anon or a Nar-Anon meeting, but I think sometimes it happens. Sometimes it happens there. I'll just say it the way that it is. It turns into this feeding frenzy of people that are hurt, that have been hurt by people's behaviors, and are right. Like, "Okay, you have to leave them. You have to this. You have to that. Don't answer that phone. Don't." And I can argue with them, but because I'm a little closer to trauma informed now, after right. my experience at the Yatra Center, I have to wonder where that comes from. And maybe it's not my place to argue with that person. Maybe it's my place to maybe point them in a direction where they can get some knowledge or understanding or something. I'm not sure, but that's all earned, man. Right? If somebody's decimated the life of you and your children, you've earned some anger, right? So,
well, sure. And right? I go to Nar-Anon because you know, my wife, and we're not together right now, but my wife is an addict as well. So I've had to learn in getting clean how to deal with the damage done, because I was never on the receiving end of an addict's behavior before.
Yeah.
Right. So it was a big remember when, but I joined Nar-Anon, and basically what Nar-Anon taught me was to just keep my side of the street clean. Like, never once. And maybe it's the group I belong to, which I'm very blessed, is, you know, they're never about telling anybody what to do, but they do tell you how to love an addict, right? They're like, you know, the do's and don'ts of Nar-Anon, you know, like the one thing I tried to do, you know, as a man in recovery, is trying to love the human and not the addict, and trying to separate the two. And that is next to impossible. And if anything, it only showed me what people had to do with me, and me having to deal with consequences that weren't mine constantly, you know, and it got to a point where, you know, I had to leave.
Conscripted soldiers, right? I call them, right? That's
yeah. The conscripted and it soldiers wasn't because war, I don't.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And it wasn't because I didn't love my wife. It was because I couldn't, you know, all the things that were happening, and I would have my friends, you know, the people I trust in my recovery, say to me, like, "You're living in a house with a using addict, and what do you think is going to happen?"
Yeah.
Right. Like, you're playing this, you know, and I played a victim. Like, "She's doing this to me. She's doing this to me." What I didn't take into consideration as an addict, we will do that to anybody.
Yeah.
It was never personal. You know what I mean? And gaslighting and narcissism are two huge things that come with addiction. It's a lot easier for me to point out how fucked up someone else is to take the emphasis off me.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
I'm this martyr, you know, let's get the polish ready for my cross, because I'm doing all the wonderful things, and this person is hurting me, and this person is hurting me. And look, you know what I mean? And once you just don't have to participate in it anymore.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And that's what it comes down to. And that's a hard thing to do, you know, and then you start realizing where your codependency comes in and things like that. Right. But that's a whole other thing.
Funny you say that. Yeah. Coda, right, is where I find myself directing people or suggesting to people to go to CODA meetings. If the Al-Anon or Nar-Anon experience has not been what they were looking for, right? Because any 12-step group, just like any group of anything, anywhere in the world to do with anything, is going to be with different souls in it, different people. You're going to have different things.
Yeah.
So I don't mean to say that Nar-Anon and Al-Anon teach this feeding frenzy kind of mentality. I mean to say that sometimes that's the experience some people have in some rooms, right?
Yeah.
I think with CODA, it's just because the focus is, let's just work on me, right? Like, this is my codependency. I need to fix that. So I think it's kind of easier for it not to go to that place, if that makes sense.
Right.
Having never 100%. Been in any one of these rooms. Right. I'm just going off what people tell me. So I'm really just speaking out my ass when I talk about it, to be honest with you. Right.
No, not at all. Yeah. Because I mean, the thing is people, I find from my experience, is that a lot of people, when they're not. So I remember when people would talk about 12-step rooms and whichever fellowship that is. And they, they all people do is sit around and talk about getting fucked up. And it's like, actually, that's frowned upon in those fucking rooms. Like, nobody wants to hear. And it's actually in the preambles, we don't care how much you used. You know what I mean? It's like, we don't
Who
want
your
to hear that
connections
shit.
were
We're
with
here to
any of
share
that
hope.
stuff. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's like, but it's some person who really didn't want to be there, who found some reason to tell somebody who doesn't know, you know, oh, well, all they do is talk about this. And it's like, you know, no, that's not true. But I understand why you're doing this, right? Because you don't want to be here. So you're going to find, you know, all the things wrong with it. And that's the problem with any of it, is if you're looking for the differences in anything, you'll find it,
Oh, and as
you
addicts,
know?
eh? We can find some resentments. Woo! We can find them.
When
That
I
is
walked out of
what.
the rooms the first time, I was like, I found, you know, I didn't like this person and fuck this guy and fuck that guy. And I walked out like this, man, and walking back in with my tail between my legs. That was, you know, but I knew I couldn't do it by myself. And I'm not the kind of guy that can. I know people that do, and good on them, man. Like, that's fucking amazing. And I'll cheer you on. Like, you don't need to do what I do as long as you're not dying. I'm cool with that. But
I
for
think
me,
when the goal becomes to save lives,
yeah.
and not to be right or to project our experience onto other people, when the goal becomes to save lives, all recovery modalities work, right? Like in
A
my
hundred
mind,
percent,
right?
like,
Whatever that
I
is.
agree.
I can take resentments, and again, I'll put one of my own experiences into the episode here. I was at 34, 35 days or something like that when I relapsed. And it's why I never went back to the rooms. It's why to this day, if you ask me how much clean time I have to do the math, because on any given day, I can't tell you. My clean date coincides with my father's passing, and it's the only real like. So if you say how much clean time I have to, you'll see me every time. I have to look at down at the bottom of the corner of the screen to see what the date is, and then do some quick math, and then I can tell you. Because keeping track of clean time as it's kind of it's one of I, it's not a tradition per se, but it's certainly the norm in the rooms, right? I've for me, I found a huge it was a resentment. It was well, there's a resentment attached to that too, but I could go back to zero. I couldn't look at myself and go back to zero and go into that room, and that kept me in relapse. What would have been a day and a half or 2 days, and I mean would have, could have, should have, all that stuff. But I feel strongly that like I would have come back from that after a day and a half, because I knew like I was like, fuck, this is not good. But I couldn't go back. Right? I couldn't go back. I couldn't say zero again. I just got, for the first time ever since I was 14 years old, I had 30 days clean. I'd never done that. Well, maybe in juvie when drugs weren't so like they weren't everywhere. Like real jail, of course, they're everywhere. But like I had never, certainly as an adult, I had never gone 30 days without getting high or something, right? And it's like I was so proud of that red fucking keychain, and boom, now I got to go back to zero. I just couldn't do it. That's why I never went back to the room. So that was kind of my experience that way. So yeah, I don't keep track of clean time, right? Until
Well, I
I look at
use
a
for the
calendar and I
simple.
went, I'm 2 weeks away from a year. I started keeping track of clean time in a hurry, right? When I was like, fuck yeah, I got a year coming, right? But no,
Well, I
anyway,
find most
continue.
addicts, and I mean, not, you know, not every addict, obviously, but I find most addicts, it goes, you know, you remember the first time you did a drug and the last time you did your drug of choice. You know what I mean? And it's like, for me, I'll never forget it because the change was so profound. Right? And it was just, I had to, you know, I keep track for the simple fact. I mean, well, it's part of the program as well, but I mean, I do it because every day that I'm doing something different, you know, if I relapse tomorrow, I would have absolutely no problem walking in and grabbing that tag. You know what I mean? Because the way it was put to me the other day, so, you know, one of the biggest sayings is keep coming back, right? And it's like, I know people that go up, you know, every meeting and get a white tag. And I think, you know, I'm always proud of them because they do keep coming back. And that makes me happy, right?
Course.
However, when it was put to me in a way that I had a hard time wrapping my head, because I used to go like, fuck, man, why aren't they getting it? You know, and it was like somebody said one time, you know, we clap because you can't come back, but we're not going like, it's okay that you relapse. We're saying keep coming back, because if you don't, one of those times you're not going to fucking make it back and you're going to die. And for most of us, it is life or death. And I
It really
think that is
is.
lost on people, right? Like, I didn't do drugs anymore to feel good. And I don't know how to do a little bit,
Yeah.
So how many more times do we think we have? I don't have another time in me.
Exactly.
If I did, I would try to come back, but I don't think I would make it back because I think I would just do it until the end.
Right. Right.
And, you know,
let's talk about that. The reality now is changed, right?
Yeah.
The reality has changed in a big way. Never before in history have we seen what's happening right now. The kind of death that's attached to drug use.
Yep.
We haven't seen since plague or war. Those are the only two things that have even come close, right? What's happening right now makes COVID look like, what the hell was COVID? Who even cares about COVID? Right?
Well,
the
kind of
death that's happening.
They're doing it right on the fucking street. Like I'm seeing families walk by and some guy with the tinfoil, you know what I mean? And I'm like,
fuck, man.
And part of me wants to go and fucking drag him behind a dumpster and go, do it here.
Right? Yeah.
But I mean, it's, you know, like, fuck, man, what do you do?
Yeah. And that's it. Right. Like, oh man. Well, just, there was a story from right close to you just the other day in the news, man. Like five people all at the same time dropped. Somebody was watching it on the street corner, the emergency rooms. Like it was an overdose, like emergency. Somewhere not far from you. Oh, I'm trying to remember where it was now. Ah, crap. It's lost on me. Somewhere in Ontario. Yeah. It was five people all at the same time out on the street, hit the sidewalk. And then the emergency rooms were full. Every hospital in town was full.
I believe that.
People overdosing all at the same time.
I was leaving church the other day and I was coming around the corner and a dude went down and I jumped out of the vehicle I was in and I ran over. And the first time in my life, I carry Narcan in every bag in my house. Like I have Narcan.
Love that. You said that in Black Ash, man.
I refused to not, but that was the one day I forgot my bag. Yeah. And so I didn't have a Narcan kit on me. And I ran out and another guy jumped out. And the guy that jumped out was an OPP or something. So he had training. And people are just walking over this guy, stepping over top of him. And I'm trying to wake him up and they're going, oh, he's still breathing. He'll be back. And one guy made a fucking joke, like he'll be back in business in no time. And I looked at him, I go, fucking really? Like that's funny to you. This guy, like, I don't even know if this guy's alive at this point. And you just walked over top of him and made a joke. Like that's how desensitized people are getting to me, the real pandemic right now. Right. Like when I look at my city and I walk downtown and every store that closed down over COVID, every cubby is now full of homeless people with tarps and they built their own. And we got tent cities everywhere. And these tent cities are full of addicts who have made their own civilization. They got their own language. They got their own set of rules. They've got their own everything. And all we're doing is shoving them deeper into the fucking hidden areas of the city. You know, to these people who have no rules anymore and they will bite your face off for a sandwich because they're in survival mode. They don't fucking care.
Yeah.
And nobody's giving them any reason to care because we're just trying to hide them. So even if we get them off,
feeling not loved, and they're feeling not lovable. Right.
No,
and that's the worst, man. That's the worst right there. By the way, Belleville, Ontario is where that was.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how far that is.
I got family there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, my nephew, I had two nephews overdose last year from Belleville.
Fuck.
You know, two of my nephews.
How far is that from you? Belleville.
Belleville is about an hour east, an hour and 20 minutes. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I spent some time out there. I worked out there briefly. I did, you know, I was a mess when I was working out there. And sure enough, I always find the guys, you know, as addicts, we always find the fellow addicts.
You give me 2 minutes in any city, man. Right.
Dude.
You give me 2 minutes, I'll be high. You give me two days, I'll be plugging, right? Like every fucking time. It doesn't matter where I go, right? I'll find a way, you know. Right?
I went out to see a buddy of mine play, and I was with some friends of mine. And I don't go to bars often, but I'm a musician, so I have to be in them sometimes. So I was in a bar, and I was watching a friend of mine play, and I was with a couple friends. And, you know, they said to me, you know, are you comfortable? And I'm like, I'm good. And I'm looking around, I go, but I can tell you every drug dealer in this place. And they started laughing. I go, that guy, that girl, and that guy.
Yeah, right.
And sure enough,
damn
man,
straight.
I'm never wrong.
Yeah, you just, my thing was I would set up shop in a pub, right? That was my thing. And I would like,
why not?
Right? Show me a bartender that does coke and I'll show you a booming business about to happen. Right? So that was my model, my business model.
So true.
Sure, right? Let's talk about your music, Chad. How's that changed as you've gone from addict to person in recovery and all those things? Like, how's that changed?
Well, for one, within a very short time of getting clean, I got signed, right? So in my 40s, I got a worldwide distribution deal, right? Now, when people say it's too late, you know, to me, I laugh because it's like, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm not making any Matchbox 20 money or anything like that. Like, I'm, you know, and at this stage of my life, I'm not willing to jump in a van and go across the country and smell my bass player's socks. I'm not into it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah,
this works for me on the level I do my life today, right? And So for one, it got a lot better. My voice doesn't blow out anymore. I'm not doing, you know, 10 shots and a few rips before I go up on stage. I'm a lot easier to deal with, you know what I mean? And the guys in my band, like, I have a really great bunch of guys in my band. Like, they're my best friends.
What's your band called?
Valier.
I know the answer, but I want you to say it on the thing.
Yeah, Valier. And you know what's funny is it's like, I have never, like, the guys in my band, they're so fucking awesome and they're such cool guys. They wave that flag bigger than I ever could. And when I was at a point, I've been clean since May of 2021. So I'm coming up on 3 years clean, right?
Congratulations, man. Yeah.
Thanks, man. Well, while I was putting my shit together and I was trying to get my life together. So this incarnation of the band has been together for 8 years, right? Pretty much since I got out of treatment right around. And, so those guys carried it for me when I couldn't handle the work part of the band, right? So while I was getting my recovery in order, while I was doing all the things, these guys carried it. And they're not like you and me. These guys can sit down at the bar and have a beer. And I don't think either of them, if I remember correctly, have ever even done a line of coke, right?
Muggles.
Yeah. So
straight muggles.
How amazing is that, right? And So these guys right away, like, they come out when I'm speaking somewhere, like, they'll come out, you know, they check in on me when we're at the bar, when we're playing. It's like, you good? Everything good? You know what I mean? If not, we don't have to play. You know, I've had them say that to me too. We can pull out of this anytime you want. It's like, no, you guys are fucking amazing and you're great foundation. They, you know, our show has just gotten like so much better, you know, I love doing it again. Like, I really lost sight of why I was there for a long time. It was just fuel, right? And music, I always came by it honestly. So, like, if I was writing about something, I meant it. But there was that whole fear that I wasn't going to have anything to write about. You know, when my whole life was drama and the different incarnations. Like, so my band, you know, I've been playing music since I was 15 years old, right? And when you're a degenerate and you're hanging, you know, when you're being a degenerate, you hang out with degenerates, right? So my, you know, previous incarnations of the band were just guys like me, aside from a couple guys that I'm still friends with throughout time. But I mean, most of the guys that were in and out of the band were lowlifes because I was a lowlife, you know what I mean? And now I got some serious cats and my bass player, I've known him since I was 10 years old. We used to run home from school to watch the Power 30, right? Dated myself, but I already told you I'm in my 40s. And you know, my I met, you know, my guitar player, I've known him for almost 20 years, right? To have these guys in the band is great. We you know, we got signed a few years ago. We're in the middle of doing a new album, which is really cool. I'm really excited about that because this is a side of us that I've been allowed to explore, right? I haven't had a chance to tap into this version of me. And when I hear, I have some board mixes of some of the songs, right? And I'm listening to them. And, you know, I always come at my music from an angle. If I wasn't in this band, would I listen to it?
Yeah.
Right? And I'm telling you, when I hear these new songs, I'm like,
that's exciting.
Man. Like, I fucking love this band. Who are these guys? Right? And it's fucking great, you know? You know, I'm so proud of these guys because these guys pulled it together while I was pulling it together, you know, and I'm so grateful to have them. And the music we're making now far surpasses anything I've ever done, you know. That's awesome. I can guarantee you it won't be. But if this is the last album I ever put out in my life, I will be fucking so happy that this is how I went out.
What else do you want, know? Right? Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah, man.
When's that due to come out? I mean,
I'm hoping summer. We're playing summer. A first show we haven't played in a little while. We had drummer problems. We got a guy lined up. I can't tell you who it is yet. We got a guy lined up. And we're playing a show in June at the Biltmore. It's called Sober Palooza. So some friends of mine, it's raising money for some treatment centers and backdoor missions out here. And so Alpha House of Toronto and backdoor missions here in Oshawa. We're raising money for that. And all the bands involved are, it's going to be a non-drinking event, which is amazing. And it's pretty exciting. June 22nd at the Biltmore in Oshawa. So there's some time, but it's going to be really fun. And I'll tell you, getting on stage when I'm sober is a lot less nerve-wracking, believe it or not. Like, I was actually afraid the first time, and I got up there. And when you know exactly what you're going to do and what you're going to say and how you're going to act, there's something freeing about that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No kidding. Just the addict brain, right? We convince ourselves that we need this to do this. And it's like, no, man, we need not to do this to do this. That's like, you know, to really do it well anyway. But we convince ourselves, right? You know, it's like,
Well, it was a weird thing because I remember one show I played and I was still lying about using. So when I first, like I said, when I relapsed and I was on that 2-year run, I was still playing shows and stuff and under the guise that I wasn't using. Right. And I can remember before I would leave, I would do some dope and the paranoia that would, you know, the overthinking, the in my head. And like we were talking earlier, I think before we started recording, you know, the way my metabolism and my brain works, when I did the up, it slowed me down.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I would go in my head and I would get silent. And like when I'm up on stage, you know, you got to rally up the crowd. You got to talk. You can't be in your head, you know, and I would get up there and I would just be like, ugh, and I'd be like, you look at these performances and you can see like, even if I performed well, I wasn't much of a stage presence because I was too busy trying to hide behind the lies. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And now I don't have to do that anymore. And now I'm like way more outgoing. And who would have thought that being sober gave me more confidence? You know,
I hear you. Yeah, 100%. Listen, we're getting to the hour mark. There's so much we can keep talking about, right? Like, there's so much. So
yeah.
I think we're just going to have you back on, right?
Anytime,
dude. Keep the conversation going, man. Absolutely. You've been a wonderful guest.
Me and you seem to have a vibe. Like, I dig that anyway.
Yeah, right, right. You know, it's just fuck. For me, you know what, man? You speak English. You're from Canada. Like, the bar's set pretty low for me. So, right? Like, you know, I'm the only white person. And I shouldn't say white person. I'm the only foreigner, right?
Maybe.
Because fuck, that sounded really, like, low-key racist. I am not. I'm the only foreigner for like a 2-mile radius, right? Like literally nobody else in this housing project. Cause when I moved to Krabi, I moved like into Krabi, right? I'm not with the tourist area. I'm like, I'm in it. Right. So nobody around me speaks English. It's very, very rare. Right.
That I have,
An in-person English conversation with somebody is really fucking rare. Right. So,
well, that's awesome.
I'm glad trying to learn the language, right? right. I'm trying to learn the language, but it's tough. You would think, like, I've been here for 3 months now. You would think that a person could like pick it up, but like Thai is a really tough language, man. It's like really tough. The alphabet is nothing like ours. Nothing like ours. Like it looks like you know, like Arabic when you see that with the weird symbols. It's very similar in like to look at, right? I'm sure somebody that knows both alphabets and like you're an idiot. No, it's not, Chuck. It's very, very different. But like
Chinese and Japanese to me looks the same, even though it's completely different.
Exactly. Same idea, right? Even though no, right? Like that's not, you know. And it's tonal. Now, I don't know if you know what that means, but there's five tones, right? So one word can mean five different things, right?
Just said
depending
in the way,
in the tone it's said, right? So for instance, there's a TikToker, I can't remember her name. It doesn't really matter anymore, but she talks about how when she got here, she was trying to learn Thai. And she would travel on her own and she would ask people, where's the person that sells the tickets? Said in the wrong tone, that's where's the hooker? Oh. Or are you a hooker? Or, right? Like, yeah. So, like, tone matters, you know, a lot. So,
I mean, it's motto. I mean, I'm up for either. No,
right. Yeah, fuck, whatever, right? When in Rome, no, right? Fuck. You know what? I'll speak to that real quick. So, like, my life in drugs was full of wine, women, and song, right? Like, it was sex, drugs, rock and roll. It was crazy. I've got more stories. They're horrible. They're wonderful. They're awful. They're great stories. Anyway,
yes.
I've lived that way. Like, as far as sexual experiences goes, I've lived my life four times over.
Yes.
Now, connection. Like, if there's, like, I have zero interest in anything casual. Zero interest right. in anything casual. Right. Like, it's just, if there isn't real connection there, then no, thank you. Right. So I,
right.
you know, I'm on the longest dry run ever as an adult I've ever had. And
right.
I'm in Thailand where,
yes.
let's be honest, like, there's a big part of the, you know, the norm yes. here. And as a foreigner, it's kind of expected almost. Right. So,
oh yeah.
you know, I did talk to a couple, you know, girls online, and right away, how much money do you make?
Right.
Like, it's just like, it's a very transactional thing here. And so for me, that's actually, it's been a real source of like kind of frustration. It's like, I'm never going to date here. Right. That's just the way it is.
Right. Well, I'm done with the casual thing too, man. Like, I just was, I was never really, I mean, back in the sex, drugs and rock and roll, of course. Right. But I have no desire for a fling. Like, I just, I'm looking for meaning, man. And you know what I mean?
Like, that change. One day you're dishing out rails and trying to figure out how to get them into a threesome. And the next day you're like, fucking like, oh no, I don't want anything casual.
You just want to be loved.
Is that so wrong? You know, no, like, I really meant chill in Netflix. Like, I meant to chill, you know,
just watch
2 years ago, it was Netflix and Bukkake, but today it's Netflix and chill. Right. Like, honestly. Yeah. Wow. I don't know. That one might get me canceled. So it's the beauty of podcasts. They can't cancel you. It's not like, you know, it's not like network TV. I mean, I guess your sponsors could hit you, but, you know, right? Yeah, yeah. So, listen, that takes us to my favorite part of the show. That's Daily Gratitudes. So what you got for us from Gratitudes today, Chad?
Wow, I'm grateful for so much today. I'm grateful for my higher power. I'm grateful that I keep meeting people like you. I'm grateful that my message is reaching people that it needs to reach. Like, my inbox, I love what my inbox looks like today. People reaching out and saying, you know, I relate and thank you for sharing so that I can, you know, I know I can get through it now too. Those are the things I live for. I'm grateful for my program. I'm grateful for, my health, and I'm so grateful for just about everything. So I'll leave it with that.
That's awesome. That's awesome. For myself, always comes down to this stupid dog all the time. Hey, Sunny, fucking Sunny. Sonny, you're an idiot. I love Sonny. Whatever you want to call him. he's like, he's so great. On that note, I'll do a quick plug. Sonny in the Sidecar, check him out on Facebook, guys. I'm kind of building that page up. He's it's me and my dog in my sidecar. It's really a milk crate on wheels here, but sidecar is a very different thing than it is at home. We cruise around Thailand. I got GoPro set up on it and, you know, a couple different angles that I work with, and we just kind of, we jam some really good times. So I'm very, very grateful for Sonny. I'm also very, very grateful to every single person who continues to like, comment, share, subscribe, do all of the things down at the bottom there, whatever the buttons are. Every time you do any one of these things, you're getting me a little bit closer to living my best life. My best life is to continue making humble living, spreading the message. The message is this: if you're in active addiction right now, today could be the day. Today could be the day that you start a lifelong journey. Reach out to a friend, reach out to a family member, call into detox, go to church, pray. I don't care. Do whatever it is you have to do to get that journey started, because it is so much better than the alternative. If you have a loved one who's suffering an addiction right now, you've just taken the time to listen to our conversation. If you can just take one more minute out of your day and text that person, let them know they are loved. Use the words.
You are loved.
That little glimmer of hope just might be the thing that brings them back. Boom. Just like that.